Go ahead and open your Bibles to Luke chapter 24. The verses that Patrick read for us this morning were the verses that lead up to the story that I want to talk about this morning. I wanted you to get the context of what's going on here, to see the full picture. And the bigger picture of what's going on here in Luke chapter 24 is the resurrection of Jesus. Now, the story about Jesus' resurrection and the reality of that resurrection, I don't know what comes to your mind when you think about the resurrection, but it wasn't something for the earliest Christians that they only celebrated once a year. This was something they thought about, that they meditated on. It's actually something they talked about every time they gathered together. The resurrection of Jesus was such an earth-shattering event, such an earth-shattering experience for these early followers of Jesus, that you find profound reflections on it in every single writing of the New Testament. It was life-changing. It was world-changing. And today we're going to look at a story that I think it's one of the most beautifully told stories in the whole of the New Testament. It's a story about two of Jesus' disciples that are really coming to terms with the reality of the resurrection, of Jesus' resurrection. But before we dive into this story, I want to set the tone for what we can learn from this story and see how it affects us in our walk with Jesus as well. I want to show you a picture. I'm betting that the majority of you have seen this picture before. Maybe all of you have seen this picture before. It's an oil painting. This is one of the most famous paintings of Jesus ever. Have you guys seen this painting before? I imagine you have. It's a painting from 1941 by a guy named Warner Salmon, and it's called The Head of Christ. This painting that you see is the most mass reproduced image of Jesus in human history. How crazy is that? There have been over 500 million prints of this painting if you include calendars and coffee mugs and all that, you know, commodity stuff. 500 million reproductions of this image. It's the most mass produced image of Jesus in known history. I remember when I was a little boy, my granny would take me to her Presbyterian church, and I'd sit there, and they had this painting on the back wall. It's like hanging right behind the podium, and I'd just stare at this painting, mesmerized by it. And I get it. I get why it's mass-produced. I mean, it's very captivating. Jesus is very handsome. He looks like he could be on Days of Our Lives, or, you know, The Young and the Restless. He looks like he'd be a lead actor in one of those shows. He's simple, he's serene, he's staring at something, we don't know what it is, so there's kind of like a mystery to it, but a purpose behind it. It's a very captivating image. Now, here's what's interesting to me. Every image or depiction of Jesus that we have has a story behind it, doesn't it? And it usually has a whole series of assumptions driving it. If you grew up with this image of Jesus, and some of you have, then whether you know it or not, this image shapes how you think about Jesus. It shapes what you believe about Jesus in probably more ways than we could ever even realize. Now, there's one really outstanding feature to this painting that would have been glaringly obvious to Jesus' followers 2,000 years ago. Anybody want to guess what that is? Right, he's a white European guy. Right, his followers back then would have been like, what? You know, he's this white, handsome, European-looking man, beautiful with long, flowing, and impeccable hair, not far from a mullet. He's kind of got a Mike Gundy thing going on. You know, and so maybe this image has influenced the way that you see Jesus in your mind and who you view Jesus as. Here's what's fascinating to me. In 2002, you probably know this as well, there was a group of British New Testament scholars, and they teamed up with a group of forensic scientists, and they did this tour of Jerusalem. They just went all throughout Jerusalem, and they got access to all these different tombs and different skulls dating back to the times of Jesus. And so, as forensic scientists do, they did all their 3D scans, and they're trying to re-image what the average Jewish man would have looked like at that time. And so they want to recreate an image of what Jesus may have looked at by getting access to all these skulls. And therefore, they thought they'll at least be close to what Jesus looks like. Here's what they came up with. Now, I'm not saying this is Jesus, but the odds are much higher that this is what Jesus looked like rather than Warner Salmon's head of Christ. The odds are much higher that Jesus was probably your average 5'5", 5'6", of a Jewish man, much darker skin, coarse black hair, much larger crooked nose than the previous image, which I can appreciate, I must say. Why are you laughing? I'm just kidding. Now, I want to ask you, don't raise your hands, but I want to ask you, who would hang this painting in their home? Who would hang this painting in their church? And if not, why? Why wouldn't you? Why is a less handsome Jesus not as appealing to people? I mean, if you're a follower of Jesus, it makes sense to have some sort of representation, you know, of him in your home. Why not hang up a more accurate representation of who he might be? Think about this. Because this taps into, it raises the age-old truth about all of us. The fact that someone's appearance drives and shapes our assumptions about that person and who they are, which really speaks to something much deeper in the human condition, and that is that we begin to generate stories based off of our assumptions about people. So that's why the white European soap opera Jesus is much more appealing to our world, at least 500 million people in our world, than the more accurate representation of Jesus. Because here's the truth. Here's what I want you to catch. We paint Jesus the way that we want to paint him in our minds. We paint him the way that we feel comfortable with. Maybe you can say it this way. We want Jesus to be like us more than we want to be like him. Our looks, our desires, our beliefs about the world, our beliefs about other people, we paint Jesus in our minds to fit our description of who Jesus should be. We need to recognize when we come to Jesus, when we sign up to be a Christian, when we follow Christ, we come, and this is true of every disciple, even from the beginning of time, and you're going to see that here in just a second. We come to Jesus with preloaded assumptions about who he is and about what he's all about, what he's wanting to accomplish in this world. And Salmon's head of Christ shows that perfectly. There's a humbling that needs to take place. There's a humbling that needs to take place and must take place. We must invest the time to get to know Jesus, to get to know him really and his desires. And if we don't do that, and if we don't humble ourselves, then there's a truth that this story will reveal to us, and that is we will actually remain blind to who he really is. This story's hard. I read it and I studied it and I put this lesson together and I still find myself struggling with this. We can be a Christian, we can go to church, and we can do this for many, many years and still remain totally blind to who Jesus actually is. So let's dive into this story. Luke chapter 2, the cross and the resurrection. If you can actually let this sink into your heart, they will shatter any assumptions that you may have about who Jesus really is. Luke chapter 24. So the tomb has already happened. These women disciples have gone to the tomb. There are these mysterious people there, and they're telling them that Jesus is not here. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? Peter has ran to the tomb, and Jesus is nowhere to be found. And then we're introduced to two of his disciples that were there. So we read that they're on their way to a village named Emmaus. That's very important. Take that, just sort of tuck it away. We'll get back to it in just a second. And what are these guys talking about? Well, what would you be talking about if you had just left, you know, the tomb and people were saying that he's alive? Yeah, you know, the things that just happened, right? I mean, these guys, Think about this. They were sold out for Christ. What if you sold half your possessions and you had followed Christ, you had left everything, you're following Jesus of Nazareth, you think he is the real deal, and so you go to Jerusalem with him for Passover, and you think, okay, this is the Redeemer of Israel. This is about to go down. It's about to get real. This is what we've been waiting for. This is the big, important, you know, religious holiday of the Jewish people. Jesus has talked about the kingdom being near and the kingdom is at hand. Here we go. Let's do this, Jesus. You lead the way. It's kind of a Gandalf on a white horse coming over the ridge moment. This is that moment. You got the army behind you. That's how they view Jesus. And then what happens? He's arrested. He's killed. If you're one of these guys, I mean, you're shell-shocked. But it even gets more weird. I mean, because some of the other disciples are like, yeah, we went to visit the tomb, but now he's gone. It's empty. We can't find Jesus. We're not sure what's going on. And so two of them, and I don't blame them. I mean, they throw their hands up and they're like, I'm done. I'm checking out. We're packing up and we're leaving. And they aren't going to stay in Jerusalem. You got to understand, the death of Jesus was a shattering tragedy for all of his disciples. Even though he clearly and plainly communicated with them what was going to happen, they had these driving assumptions about who Jesus is and what he was about that shaped their image of him, so much so that when the real Jesus came about, they couldn't even see him. And when everything fell apart, they didn't even really understand who he was. And so you have two guys that are packing up and leaving. Watch what happens. So they're walking and talking, and who appears beside them? Jesus. And this becomes sort of the center point of the story. The risen Savior is walking with them, and can they see him? Well, yeah, he's a man in the flesh. They can see that there's a man talking with them. But do they know that it's Jesus? No. So they can see him, but they can't actually see him. Do you get it? This is one of the most beautiful, artistically told stories in the New Testament about someone who's walking alongside Jesus and has been for a very long time, and yet they cannot recognize who he really is. It's as powerful an image as you will find about what it means to truly be a disciple of Jesus. Notice what the text says. It says, their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So, something keeps their eyes from truly recognizing Jesus. They can see that it's a Jewish man walking along with them, but they don't know him. And what keeps them from recognizing him? Well, keep reading. So Jesus says to them, hey, what are you guys talking about? The irony in this story is so thick, you can just cut it with a knife. Jesus comes up, he's walking with them. Hey, what are you guys talking about? And they stop, they're kind of downcast, they're sad, you know. And we learn one of their names is Cleopas, who basically says, are you serious? Like, are you the only person in Jerusalem who doesn't know what's gone down this weekend? Are you seriously asking us, what are we talking about? Cleopas is blown away by this question. But not only does Jesus know what happened, he is what happened. And he asks him, watch what he says, what things? I love it. I love the sense of humor of Jesus. If you study the Bible a lot, you'll see it from time to time. What thing? No, I don't know what happened. What things? And they said to him, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, listen to their depiction of him. This is how they view Jesus. This is the painting that they've painted in their minds. A man who was a prophet, mighty indeed, and the word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But wait for it, here it is. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Let's stop right there a second. Because they've just showed their hand, haven't they? They don't know it, but you know it as a reader. They've just exposed what was blinding them. You see, for them, the death of Jesus was not a victory. It was a defeat. It ruined the whole plan. It shattered everything. They thought Jesus was a prophet who was going to redeem Israel through his words, through his deeds. But man, all of that was lost. It's all over with. Jesus was not who they assumed he was. They had a different picture of Jesus painted in their minds. Now, the language is so loaded here because in reality, does Jesus believe that he redeemed Israel on the cross? Well, yeah, absolutely. Of course he does. So exactly the thing that they think made Jesus a failure is exactly the thing in the story of the gospel that made Jesus victorious. Now, before we beat up on these guys and before we say, man, what dummies to not realize this, you need to sympathize with them a little bit and see where they're coming from and think about your own life and where you're coming from as we do this, okay? So you got to do a little bit of homework on this word redemption or redeem. This word has a lot of history and plays a big role in the story of the Bible. Redeem is one of the most religious words you can throw out there. And these guys grew up with this word. Where in the Bible do you think you hear about redemption first? What story do you think you read about, you read this word redeem first, if you had to guess? Well, I'll tell you. It's in the story of the Exodus. And this is right before Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." You know, you've seen the movie, Charlton Heston, it's a powerful scene. Let my people go. This is when this takes place. Here's the first appearance of the word redeem in the Bible. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the groaning of the people of Israel, whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment." So this is the first time you come across the idea of redemption in the Bible. And what's it about? Well, it's a story about the liberation of slaves from oppression into freedom, into the freedom of being God's chosen people. That's what redemption means. It means that God does something to purchase, to liberate slaves, and then create them into his purchased possession. And so, for these two young Jewish disciples of Jesus to have hopes for Jesus to redeem them and all of the Jews, well, what does that mean? They're looking for somebody to deliver them from slavery. Because for these two, Jesus' death is a tragic event, which means that he wasn't the one that they thought he was. So in their day and time, who's the Pharaoh? Who's the oppressor of Jewish people in Jesus' day? Well, the Romans. And who's the Pharaoh in Jesus' day? A guy named Caesar Augustus. And he's got this crony puppet guy in Jerusalem called Pilate. And Pilate's actually the one that executed or gave the order to execute Jesus. And so think about this. If there's a Messiah and he's going to redeem them, then he's going to what? He's going to slaughter some Romans. He's going to kill some Romans and he's going to liberate the Jews. I mean, give these guys a break. It's Passover weekend. They've just celebrated Passover. And what story does Passover retell? The Exodus story, the story of redemption. So sympathize with these two for a minute. Imagine that you've grown up with these tales. Imagine that you've grown up with these stories of your ancestors, and you know that there's a Redeemer coming. You know there's a Messiah coming. And then Jesus comes around. He's talking about the kingdom of heaven. He's talking about redemption. He's doing all this amazing stuff. It's Passover weekend. It's go time. You're ready to fight. And then he's killed. How do you feel about your life if you're these two? Now, there's one more piece to this story that will help you see the full weight of what's going on here. Do you remember where they're headed? Emmaus. Now, The biblical authors, they seem to spare a lot of details in their writings, which frustrates me. I don't know if that frustrates you, but a lot of details that they seem to spare. But when you come across specific details such as this one, pay attention, because they're trying to tell you something. So they're going to a town called Emmaus. Why would Luke tell us that? Think of it like this. If I were to tell you that Amanda and I wanted to take a trip to learn more about World War II history, and I told you, so we're going to visit Pearl Harbor. Right? All I have to do is say the name Pearl Harbor, and what happens? Immediately, visions flood your mind. You immediately associate a lot of things with the name Pearl Harbor. Or if I say, hey, we want to study more about the American Civil War, so we're going to go visit Gettysburg. That's all I'd have to say. And all of a sudden, visions flood your mind. You know the story. So you get the idea here. The readers of this letter, they connect Emmaus to a story. And everyone would have immediately picked up on this. Here's the story. The famous Battle of Emmaus. This is 150 years before Jesus. It's not the Romans in charge at this time. It's a group called the Assyrians. And so there's a Jewish uprising against the Syrians, led by a Jewish family known as the Hammer. How cool is that? The Hammers. In Hebrew, they're known as the Maccabees. But they're led by this guy named Judas Maccabee. Judas the Hammer, the great savior Judas. You can just see it's coming out in theaters in 2 weeks. This is how they think about this. Here's the story in short. Now the Syrian general Gorgias, that's the enemy in this story, took 5,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry to attack the camp of the Jewish people and strike them suddenly. But Judas the Hammer, he heard of it, and he and his warriors moved out to attack the forces at Emmaus. At daybreak, Judas appeared in the plain with 3,000 men. As they saw the camp of the Gentiles strong and fortified with cavalry all around it, Judas said to those who were with him, and this is as great of a battle cry as you'll ever read. Listen to this. Do not fear their numbers or be afraid when they charge. Remember how our ancestors were saved at the Red Sea. Listen to the story that he's telling. Remember how our ancestors were saved at the Red Sea when Pharaoh and his forces pursued them. So now let us cry out to heaven to see whether God will favor us and remember his covenant with our ancestors and crush this heathen army before us today. Then all the Gentiles will know there is one who does what? Who redeems and saves Israel. This is their Braveheart moment. You can take our wives, but you'll never take our freedom. You know, all the swords clinging, all the swords. This is that moment. So you have these two first century Jewish men. They're raised on these stories. I mean, they know redemption. They've watched the movies. They played out this story of Judas the Hammer in their mind time and time again. And now they're headed to the place where it happened. And you have Jesus who claims to be here to redeem Israel. And so what have they done? Well, they painted a picture in their mind of who Jesus is. And so what is the first order of business when we arrive in Jerusalem on Passover? The first order of business is to kill our enemies. You're going to attack the Antonia Fortress, which overlooks the temple. That would be the best first move. This is your game plan. This is how you redeem a people. They quickly find out Jesus had a very different vision of what redemption means. Jesus knows what true redemption looks like. It wouldn't involve him killing anybody. It would involve him being killed. And apparently, these two missed out on the various teachings of Jesus that showed that. Apparently, they missed out on the times that Jesus said things like this from Luke chapter 6. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. And whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to everyone who asks of you. And whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. Treat others the same way that you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. But love your enemies. And do good. And lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to ungrateful and evil people. Who says stuff like this? Jesus has a vision of what it means to redeem a fallen people. He has a vision of what it means to be a human being, to be a part of the true kingdom of God, who follows him and lives under God's reign. And it's a very different way of life than most humans ever dreamt of. Jesus claims that the true way to defeat evil is by doing good, and by suffering, and by sacrificial love. And then Jesus goes into Jerusalem, and he walks what he talks. He lives this out in the flesh. Jesus goes into Jerusalem with his disciples, and it's during Passover. And think about what he does here. He breaks the bread, and he gives it to them. He takes the cup, and he gives it to them. And he says, these symbols are of my broken body, of my blood being poured out. This is the story of redemption. And he reshapes their image to tell the true story of redemption. And Jesus did believe that he was accomplishing an exodus, but not by becoming Moses, but by becoming the sacrificial lamb. Now, I don't know about you, but it doesn't matter how many times I read sayings like this, and I read the sayings of Jesus, I think if most of us are honest with ourselves, we sort of think, really? I mean, really? That just doesn't make sense. It's almost as crazy as saying something like, you know what? If you want to save your life, lose your life. And if you really want to be the most influential person around, you go to the bottom and you be a slave of everyone. We like to sugarcoat that verse. We say a servant of everyone, but the Greek actually means a slave of everyone. Jesus came and he had a totally upside down view of the world. And so you have these two disciples, and most of us walk down this road with Jesus. And in our minds, we painted Jesus as Warner Solomon's head of Christ, this very kingly, this very handsome Jesus, this Jesus who is too nice to actually require something of us, to cost us something, to actually mess up our plans. But the real Jesus, the Jesus you need to get to know, he's going to bother you, just like he bothered these disciples. He will actually shatter everything that you thought you knew about him, everything that you thought you knew about the kingdom of God. And so the question is it possible to travel alongside Jesus and never actually experience and know the real Jesus? Well, it's very possible. In fact, this has been the experience of every single disciple of Jesus ever, to walk alongside him and not truly know who he is and what he's about. So how does this resolve? How do they come to see Jesus? Watch this, it's fascinating. Well, now they tell him, Jesus, that they're even more confused because no one can seem to find the body of Jesus, and so they're telling him the story got even weirder. And then in verse 25, Jesus says to them, you fools, oh foolish ones and slow of heart. And that's a good Hebrew Jewish idiom is what that is. And slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And so he's having a little Bible study with them as he's walking down the road. And he finishes this little on-road Bible study. They still don't get it. They still don't recognize him. So watch how this plays out. Notice what Jesus does. He isolates the problem that they have. It's their hearts. Their hearts are what's preventing them from seeing Jesus. It's all these preloaded assumptions that they have about who he is and who he was. And even though they're standing right beside him, because of their hearts, they can't see him. They can't recognize him. And so he takes them through the scriptures. And it's the story that begins with the fact that all humanity is hopelessly caught up in this web of sin. Not just the heathens, not just the Egyptians, not just the Gentiles, everyone. We're all contributors to this mess, are we not? In one way or another, whether it's Pharaoh, whether it's Judas the Hammer, whether it's Caesar Augustus, whether it's Boo Scott, whether it's the disciples, it's all of us. We have met the enemy, and the enemy is us. They have this view that God is only on their side, and since the Romans are their enemies, they are also God's enemies. But the story of the Bible completely obliterates that assumption. Jesus walks them through this story and reveals to them that God's ultimate purpose was not to come to kill and destroy the enemy, but actually to die for the enemy. That's God's ultimate purpose. His ultimate purpose was to bind himself to the human condition through his son Jesus, and therefore be victorious over death and victorious over evil through his resurrection. I read this story, and it causes us to have to rethink everything we thought we knew. Every assumption that we bring to the table, every assumption that we bring to Christ, we have to let it be reshaped and rebuilt by the resurrection of Christ. Now watch where this goes. Hang on with it, because it gets fascinating. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He acted as if he were going farther. So Jesus, another human Roman, he's like, I got to go see a guy about a horse. You know, he's like, I don't really want to hang around. But they talk him into hanging around. They strongly urge him, saying, stay with us, for it's toward evening and the day is now far spent. So he went in to stay with them. Here it is. Absolutely mind-blowing. When he was at the table with them, he took the bread and blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to them. Now stop right there. Do you get it? You see what he's doing here? When was the last time that he broke bread with these disciples? Passover. Not that long ago. He broke bread, and he gave the cup to these disciples, and he said, take, eat, this is my body. Take, drink, this is my blood, which is shed for all mankind. And look at what the text says. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. And then he vanishes. More humor, I think. Focus on this. It's only when a disciple of Jesus humbles themselves. It's only when you check all your baggage at the door and you reject all the assumptions that you may have about Jesus and that you allow the scandal of the cross, the scandal of a crucified God in the flesh, to come and reshape you. We do this every Sunday, don't we? We break the bread, we drink the cup, and sometimes it becomes such a ritual for us that we forget what's happening. Sometimes we need to stop and think about it, because it's at the heartbeat of the whole story that God defeats evil and God defeats his enemy by actually dying for his enemy. And that is so not how we are, is it? That is so not who we are. When Jesus told Peter that he was going to die and then raise 3 days later, Peter said, That's not going to happen. Jesus says, get behind me, Satan, for you do not have the concerns of God in mind. You merely have human concerns. You see, that's where our focus is. We're focused on human concerns. What can I get out of this? How do I benefit my kingdom? How do I benefit my nation? How do I benefit my family? God, you can't die. That's not the image I have painted of you in my mind. You like the things that I like. You believe the things that I believe. You're against the people that I'm against. And through the bread and through the cup, we see true redemption. I mean, do I even need to bring up the outpouring of hatred and vengeance that's happening right now in our culture towards our enemy? And who is your enemy? Well, for a lot of you, it's the person on the other side of the political aisle. Some of you would say that your enemy, or you wouldn't say it, but some of your enemies is the person of a different religion. Some of you would say that your enemies are those who claim a different sexual orientation. Some might even say that their enemy is a person of a different race or a person from a different country than ours. Some of us have walked with Jesus for such a long time and we're convinced that he hates the same people that we hate. We can't see Jesus. We're convinced that Jesus has the same goals that we have. And Jesus would say, you foolish people, your heart is in the wrong place. Have you been with me this long and you still don't know me? Do you still think this is about conquering somebody? Do you still think that my kingdom is of this world? There is a deeper, more mysterious evil within this world that has tricked us all into thinking that we win by killing and fighting each other. Paul talks about it in Ephesians. You just studied it in Bible class. Your war is not against flesh and blood, but by the evil cosmic powers that are unseen. They've tricked us into thinking that we are supposed to fight each other. They tricked these disciples into thinking that. But the story of the gospel reveals that we're all contributors to this evil. And the good news surrounding the bread and the cup is that God loves his enemies. And he's laid down his life for them. And we're reminded of that every time we break bread together, every time we drink of the cup. Stop painting Jesus the way that you want to see him. And let your eyes be open to what true redemption looks like. May you love your enemies. May you lay your life down for those you despise. May you stand up for truth, but may you do so in love. May we humble ourselves and throw our assumptions out. May we leave our baggage at the door, and may we have eyes to see who Jesus really is. And may we pursue him, and may we pursue his purpose above our own. Maybe today you've been blinded to Jesus. You've been walking with him for a long time. And you need help opening your eyes. I know I do a lot. We want to pray for you. We want to help you. Whatever needs you may have, come as we stand and sing.